Support for the morning show comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe. Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. Support for the morning show also comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad. And we welcome you to the Wednesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. That is the fine playing of the Racine Concert Band, or as I persist in calling them, the Racine Municipal Band. Mark Eichner, as he got to the studio, was good-naturedly telling me that they haven't been called that for 20 years now, but that's still in my mind the first thing I call this fine group of musicians. They are the Racine Concert Band, and Mark Eichner is their music director and conductor. And as we did with Craig Gall, who would be Mark Eichner's counterpart here in Kenosha, as we did with Craig a couple of weeks ago, we're now speaking with Mark Eichner on the eve of yet another summer season of performances by the Racine Concert Band, most, if not all of which, will be taking place on the grounds of the Racine Zoo, right beside Lake Michigan. It's a beautiful setting to enjoy wonderful music making. And we'll be hearing more from the band through the course of this interview, which is part one of today's morning show. Mark Eichner, we welcome you back to the morning show.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Good to have you here. What was the piece we were listening to, by the way?
That was a movement from Alexander Tcherepanin's Bagatelles. Tcherepanin was a DePaul composer for about 20 years in the late 20th century.
That's a great piece of music, and your musicians play it very, very impressively. Remind me, how long have you been at the helm of the Racine Concert Band, and at what point in its history was the beginning of your tenure?
I became the conductor in 2002, so this is my 15th year. And the band's been very lucky because in our 93-year history, we've only had five conductors, which has led to a lot of continuity and has really kept the band strong through all those years.
Right. And I know that your predecessor, Del Eich, is still very much involved in the group, which I know means a lot to you and to a lot of people involved with the band.
You know, when I started with the band president said, well, Del might want to stay on for maybe 1 or 2 years as business manager to help with the transition. And now, 15 years later, he's more involved now than he was even then. So he's been a great source of support and advice, and he's there at every single concert.
That's just great. That's great. Give us a little history lesson, if you would, about the creation of the Racine Concert Band. And I ask you that with no hesitation whatsoever. But, you know, in some cases, with some people, somebody might not even bother to know the history of the ensemble that they're conducting. But I know you're a man of history and know this history well and appreciate it.
Well, this is the band's 93rd season, so we are 1 year younger than the Kenosha Pops band. But the antecedents of the Racine Concert Band go back to the 1860s.
Wow.
The Schultes, which were the first two conductors of the band, had bands before that in Racine that went back to the 19th century. And so the band started as the Racine Park Board Band and funded by the city. And so that's why we were called the Municipal Band for so many years. And we're proud of our affiliation with the city. We still receive a city subsidy, although it's only about 55% of our budget now. But we are the official band of the city of Racine, and we really appreciate the support we receive from the mayor and all the aldermen.
Has the performance home of the Racine Concert Band always been the Racine Zoo? I mean, has how long has that bandstand been in place where you typically perform on Sunday evenings?
The Kiwanis Amphitheater was built in the 1980s, and one of the main purposes of building the Kiwanis Amphitheater was to give a permanent home for the Racine. At that time, the municipal band changed to the concert band, I think, in 1996. And so it's been a great home for us because it is such a beautiful setting and it's such great views of the lake, and the acoustics are pretty good, too. There's plenty of room for the audience. I do need to point out that just for this week only, our opening concert on July 3rd isn't going to be at the amphitheater. It will be at the zoo. But it's going to be at an alternate venue near the main gate. So the band will be playing right next to the Primate building. And so we just for this one concert, the audience is asked to come in through either the main gate or the Walton Street gate at the corner of Main and Walton. But the Augusta Street gate will not be open for this July 3rd concert. Hmm.
Do I remember that there's other places where the band occasionally performs? Including performances that are not during the summer season at all?
Sure. During the school year, we partner with each of the Racine Unified High Schools, and we give joint concerts at Case High School and Park High School and Horlick High School. And that's a lot of fun because we get to collaborate with the students and the conductors there, both in class and in performing. And we enjoy that quite a bit. Mm.
So tell us who, by and large, populates the Racine Concert Band. Who are these musicians who play under your baton?
Well, we have a substantial number of music educators in the group. But they come from all walks of life. We have librarians and nurses, and we have some manufacturing business owners and bakers and all walks of life. But one thing they have in common is they all take their music very seriously, and we're really proud of the performance standard we've achieved in recent years.
With good reason. So how does somebody become a member of the band? I suspect they don't just show up with their flute the first night of rehearsal.
Well, our method is somewhat unique in that we don't have auditions for open positions. We like to maintain a large substitute list, and when we call them to be substitutes, we try to invite substitutes who've given us strong performances to become a member of the band.
Hmm. And I suppose that one of your goals as music director is to foster a really high level of excellence and to, if anything, see that level of excellence increase over the years. How does one do that?
Well, it's been really rewarding, and you only build it one brick at a time. but over the years, it doesn't just come from me. It comes from the musicians themselves, you know, who demand a higher standard of themselves, but also from the through their leadership. They demand it from the person sitting next to them and the person sitting next to them, too. So, one of the things I really enjoy about conducting the Racine Concert Band is when we rehearsed last night, it was about 5 minutes to 7, and everyone was seated, everyone had been practicing and warming up and ready to go, and everyone was just anxiously waiting for the minute hand to reach 12 so the rehearsal could get going. And that's just a really good vibe.
Oh, my gosh, that's the best feeling in the world. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Mark Eichner, who is music director of conductor of the Racine Concert Band. And their newest season is about to begin this Sunday, the 3rd of July, with a performance in the Racine Zoo, although not in their customary place, but in an alternate location next to the Primate House. And thereafter, they'll be in the Kiwanis Pavilion, where they typically perform on Sunday evenings at 7:30 p.m. Mark, you brought another performance along that we're going to sample right now. First of all, tell us what piece of music this is, and maybe even the occasion where it was recorded.
Sure. This performance was given, I think, February 24th at Horlick High School.
This year?
Yes. Mm-hmm. And the piece is called October by contemporary fairly young composer, Eric Whitaker.
Oh, he's very famous for his choral music. I had no idea he wrote anything else besides choral music. Huh.
Actually, he has transcribed some choral pieces for wind ensemble that surprisingly work really well.
Wow. Well, this is news to me and maybe to a lot of people listening. Okay, so here is music of Eric Whitaker, and this is the Racine Concert Band. Beautiful, beautiful music of Eric Whitaker. What was the title of that piece again?
October.
And we've finished it just before its ending. We'll give you the conclusion of that wonderful music as we finish out this interview in a few minutes. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking today with Mark Eichner, who is music director and conductor of the Racine Concert Band. And their 93rd summer season is about to begin with a concert this Sunday evening at 7:30 p.m. At the Racine Zoo. And for Sunday evenings thereafter, through the middle of August. And it's a season that a lot of people are looking forward to with great interest, including those of us who are privileged to stand with the band and perform with them. Mark Eichner, say just a word about how the concerts get put together. My sense is, although every night is always kind of a refreshing new thing, that you have a strong sense of tradition, and that the way each and every concert unfolds adheres to a pretty strong sense of tradition.
Well, surprising even to me, I found that the general format of an outdoor concert, as John Philip Sousa planned them a century ago, still works. We've modernized it, and we've certainly updated the repertoire.
Right.
But the sort of flow that he had of introducing the concerts with fanfares and marches, and then moving on to more substantial, in his case, they were usually operatic or symphonic transcriptions, and then soloists, more marches, more soloists, and then more popular kinds of music towards the end. That's a formula that still works really well. We don't play the same music that was played in the Sousa concerts. We try to keep the band repertoire fresh and include as much new music as possible in an outdoor setting with that one rehearsal concert. But still, Sousa knew what he was doing.
And you just raised a good point about an outdoor setting, that there are probably certain pieces of music that either don't work at all or really only work to a limited extent in an outdoor venue versus something that would work wonderfully in a sort of warmer, more forgiving indoor acoustic.
Absolutely. In some cases, I've learned the hard way about those pieces. With a band with a 93-year-old tradition, we have a very extensive library. And when I'm stacking all these scores up and trying to winnow them down into seven concerts, there's really a great many pieces left on the table that I'd really love to perform, but they just don't fit in this year's programs.
Right, right. How big is that library anyway? Have you bothered to count? Or, I mean, do you have even a rough idea of how many pieces we're talking about? I should think it's immense after all these years.
It is quite immense. It really fills the entire band office. And I know Dell's valued it at over $100,000. So,
wow. So tell our listeners about the season, which is coming up, and what they can look forward to with each of the concerts.
Well, the band repertoire is largely marches and symphonic setting of folk music. And we try to do some more substantial concert pieces. Very often those are still transcriptions of wonderful ballet music or opera music. And many of those do work really well in the park. And we have very strong soloists now within the band. In fact, we have so many strong soloists, it's not even possible to get them all on one summer season. So it's great to work with such wonderful musicians that work that hard. And we have a very wonderful group of vocal soloists that come and sing with us each year, both Greg and Kathy Berg, and we have Jeannie Hatfield, Allison Hull, Amy Bodersee, Melissa Cardaman. They all make a really wonderful impression at these concerts.
I noticed there on the 7th of August, you'll even step into the spotlight as trumpet soloist. What are you going to be playing on that occasion?
I'm going to be playing The Charmer, which is very much in the style of the kind of pieces my college trumpet teacher used to play. My college trumpet teacher was Frank Alsass, who was a wonderful guy, and he was a soloist in the Goldman Band in New York. And so he was expected to play two or three trumpet solos every week, and they might not even be the same one.
Wow.
And he was a wonderful guy, and when he retired from the band, he taught first at Fort Hays State and then to the University of Texas, where I studied with him.
Very good.
So it's kind of an homage to Frank Alsace.
I think that's neat. When is it and how is it that you first fell in love with the trumpet?
Well, in school band. I mean, I started in fourth grade in the Chicago public schools, and my family moved to Texas, and high school band, you know, school bands are very strong and very large, and it's a big competitive sport there.
Yeah, right. Did you think about anything else, or was it just trumpet from the start?
Not other instruments, but I didn't go to college as a music major.
Oh.
I started thinking that I would be a math major, and my calculus convinced me that music was a good place for me.
Very good. And when is it that you came to the University of Wisconsin-Parkside?
1982.
Great. So how long have you been retired from Parkside?
2 years now.
Is retirement still feel strange, or are you enjoying it?
It did for a while, but I've channeled my energies in different directions now, and there's many projects to work on, and they're all very satisfying.
Right. And I suppose that one nice thing is that I think that means you were still at Parkside at the time that this fantastic new facility, the Rita, opened. I mean, you got to see the opening of the Rita.
Right. And that was a project that we worked on for 16 or 17 years, I think, between the time that we initially got on the list because our space was overused. And so I was department chair for 9 years dealing with all those state planners, working out every little detail, including which direction the doors would open and what kind of lock would be on them.
Oh, wow. The kind of things you just don't think about. It's not just what's going to be the most beautiful, what's going to be the most dazzling. It's
those
kind of small little details.
Jillions of details.
Wow. Well, it's a wonderful space, and it's a place, obviously, where a lot of people can come and enjoy the wonderful offerings of the Parkside Music Department. In the meantime, back to our business at hand. We're about to finish the Eric Whitaker piece that we were hearing before to finish out your time with the morning show. Explain to somebody who's never been to one of these Sunday night concerts of the Racine Concert Band exactly where they go, exactly what they should do in order to drink in all the great music.
Sure. The July concerts begin at 7:30 p.m., and the August concerts begin at 7 o'clock. And that has something to do with the fact that the band looks directly into the sun at sunset. So we like to get done, we like to start when the sun is pretty low, but we try to be done before dark anyway. So that's the reason for two different start times.
So interesting. So the July concerts are at 7:30, the August concerts are at 7.
Right. Okay. And normally, after this week, the Augusta Street Gate will be open, as well as the Walton Street Gate, for concert attendance. It's free admission to the zoo starting 30 minutes before the concert time. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'm reminded of how Don Rosen, who is our master of ceremonies at the concerts, told me that he became a regular attender of the concerts before he was the MC, and he said his wife was coming to the concerts, and she kept asking him to come along, and he said, no, I'm not really into those outdoor concerts. And finally he said yes just to get her off his back, and he came one time, and he said, I was hooked.
Wow.
So they are a really kind of special Racine event, and until you've been, you don't really know what you're missing. So
absolutely.
Come on out.
Absolutely. Hope many people will take advantage of that opportunity. And again, the first performance of the Racine Concert Band is at the Racine Zoo this Sunday night at 7:30 p.m. And then subsequent Sunday evenings through the 14th of August, which will be your finale for the season. And by that point, the concerts will begin at 7 p.m. Does the band have a website people should visit?
RacineConcertBand.org. But I have to caution that website's just going to open later this week because we lost our previous website and we're reorganizing.
Got it. All right. So at some point that will be open for business. Well, at any rate, the 93rd concert season of the Racine Concert Band is about to get underway under the direction of Mark Eichner. Mark Eichner, great to have you here, and best wishes to you and everybody in the band.
A pleasure as always.
It's 8:38, and you're listening to The Morning Show on WGTD, your gateway to public radio. Here is part two of today's program. I am very excited about the opportunity to speak with a very, very highly admired author and historian by the name of Nick Bunker, who is responsible for a number of fascinating books, including Making Haste from Babylon, which is one of the best books ever written about the Mayflower and the first years of the Plymouth Colony. His newest book is called An Empire on the Edge, How Britain Came to Fight America. And in it, we have the perspective from the Brits of just what exactly led to the fighting of the Revolutionary War. And that is a story which we Americans almost exclusively think about and view through the prism of our own understanding and perspective as Americans. And Mr. Bunker is a very dispassionate and unbiased observer of history in a sense, and yet also brings to the table a British perspective, which is so helpful in understanding just what brought the American Revolution about. And so much of it is about Britain and its all but unmanageable empire at the time, and in particular their difficulty and maybe even incompetence when it came to overseeing the vast reach of the North American continent. It's a fascinating story, and this book, now available in paperback from Vintage, a division of Random House, is again called An Empire on the Edge, a Pulitzer Prize finalist. Nick Bunker, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Well, thank you, Greg. Hello.
I'm so excited to be talking with you. Briefly, I wonder if you would share with our listeners a story which I saw you share in some sort of interview about what prompted your own interest in America. And I believe you credit that in a sense to having read some National Geographic issues a long time ago. Just say it's an interesting story. Tell our listeners briefly about that.
Absolutely right. It's, when I was a very small boy in England, when I used to be taking my mother to the dentist, the dentist surgery was always piled high with old copies of the National Geographic. And this was the 60s, mid-60s, and what he had was a number of copies of National Geographic which dealt with the centennial of the Civil War. And so I would sit there reading these magazines, absolutely fascinated by all these stories about Stonewall Jackson and the various battles, Gettysburg and so forth. And so that really, when I was a small boy, was what prompted my interest in American history. And then, of course, as I was growing up in the 60s and 70s, our television screens were always filled every evening with dramatic events from the United States, whether it be the space program or the Vietnam War, or later, of course, Watergate, which was absolutely fascinating. So really, my interest in American history does go back to that era.
Mm. Well, I'm glad it did, because, of course, your book about the Mayflower is so highly regarded, and this latest book is especially fascinating. I think one of the places we should examine with some detail is the state of the British Empire at this point in time, in these years right before the Revolutionary War was fought. At one point in the book, you describe it as an odd and fragile empire that no one had designed and very few people could claim to understand. Explain a little further the way in which the British Empire at this point in time in particular was an odd and fragile empire.
Well, it originated, you see, as a kind of privatized empire back in the 17th century. The Crown of England, although it had been quite keen to see colonies and plantations, both in Ireland but also in America and in the West Indies, never really had the resources to be able to undertake the work of plantation and colonization itself, so that it was kind of farmed out and subcontracted to private enterprise. And the empire, therefore, had a kind of unplanned, slightly kind of inchoate kind of feel to it throughout its first century or so of existence. Now, From time to time, the British would try to introduce a bit of regularity. They would try to introduce some tighter control from the centre. And they did this, for example, in the 1680s. And again, they started trying to do it from about the 1740s. But the difficulty was really twofold. First of all, that the British didn't really want to spend money on administration of their empire. They didn't really want to spend resources. And also, they tended to become distracted by other events. At the end of the day, what was going on in Europe, what was going on in the kind of the diplomatic situation in Europe and the machinations of the French and the Prussians and the Austrians and so on, tended to loom far more heavily in their minds than events 3,000 miles away and across the other side of the Atlantic.
Hmm. At one point you say that part of the problem here was that North America was a continent which she, meaning Britain, did not comprehend and could not hope to rule. And they never had any kind of solid plan for administering the American colonies. I'm just curious, how true was that for other parts of the British Empire? I mean, was it equally true or was it exceptionally true that North America was, in a sense, this incomprehensible place that the Brits just did not really begin to understand? And didn't bother to come to a better understanding of it until it was too late.
Well, if you take the various other elements of the British Empire, really there were two others. The West Indies, the British West Indies, essentially Jamaica, Barbados, Antigua, and so on. And also, of course, the new empire in India and the Far East. Now, the part of the British Empire that was most understood and that was most heavily under control were the sugar colonies in the West Indies. But that, of course, was because though they were relatively small in terms of population and size, they were also exceptionally valuable. Now, the Indian situation was a different one out in Bengal, centered on Calcutta. The situation there was that the British had, in the course of about 20 years prior to the American Revolutionary War, they had managed to acquire this enormous territorial empire, which they hadn't initially expected to do. They had simply been beneficiaries of what was effectively the breakup of the Mughal Empire at that time. So they had found themselves in possession of this vast territory, including what is now the whole of the modern nation of Bangladesh, the whole of the Indian states of West Bengal and Bihar. This is a vast, vast area. And again, you see, it took many, many years. It took perhaps 30, 40 years or so before the British actually worked out a viable way of controlling those territories. It took them until actually into the 19th century. So America wasn't exceptional. The other difficulty in America was, of course, that America effectively did have its own government, or rather it had 13 governments of its own, because each of the colonies had its own little parliament or colonial assembly. And, of course, they really, by the time of the 1770s, were effectively the government for all intents and purposes in those areas.
More so than Britain's government.
Well, yes, really. I mean, most of the day-to-day work of government was actually being done by Americans themselves, particularly in Massachusetts and Rhode Island in New England, where effectively the colonists were running their own affairs on a town and county basis, so they were used to a kind of habit of autonomy. And the problem really in 1774-5 was that the British, in response to the Boston Tea Party, suddenly tried to take this autonomy of New England away. Well, that was obviously something that was going to lead to severe problems.
It sounds like one of the most serious mistakes which Great Britain made was the way in which they viewed North America. And by the way, I would also be curious to know if, again, this was exceptionally true about North America or if this was equally true of other parts of their empire, but saw it almost entirely in terms of commerce. In fact, at one point, I think you talk about how Britain had, in effect, two overlapping empires, political and commercial, and they were almost completely preoccupied with the commercial aspect and neglected the other, which was a big reason why the situation turned as troubled as it did.
Yes, I mean, in this I actually differ from some other British historians currently. I mean, in the last 20 years or so, there have been a number of British historians who have argued that the British actually did have quite a comprehensive imperial ideology and that they saw themselves as very much a British empire, Protestant and et cetera. Now, my view is probably a slightly more traditional one, which is that actually essentially was simply a money-making enterprise. The British weren't really terribly ideological at this period. They weren't really terribly interested in abstract ideas about politics and so on. What they were basically interested in doing was simply having an empire that generated large amounts of wealth for the mother country by way of the flow of tobacco and sugar and so forth back across the North Atlantic and the export of manufactured goods to Americans who couldn't make manufactured goods of their own. So I do see it very much as a commercial empire. And also, the British Empire at the time, in its commercial aspect, was also speculative. Basically, what it was doing was to engage in a lot of speculative trading in commodities, the ones I mentioned, sugar, tobacco, tea coming back from China. And therefore, it was also an empire that was heavily financed by debt, both private sector debt as well as public sector debt, that is to say, debt from private individuals as well as debts owed by the state. And that, of course, again, meant that it was kind of inherently fragile and unstable. You know, sooner or later, there was going to be a situation where a financial or a commercial crisis coincided with a political crisis, and that's essentially what happened in the 1770s. And the British government simply couldn't cope. They didn't really have any way to think through the problems they were dealing with, and they didn't really have any administrative mechanism to sort out the various problems that arose.
Hmm. How significant was the banking crash, which I believe occurred in 1772, and what were the most important ramifications for that in terms of this period and this situation which your book examines?
Well, it was very severe. I mean, in the 18th century, there were two great financial crises. One was the South Sea Bubble in the early 1720s, and the other one was the crash of 1772, and it came about for the classic reasons. There had been a great big boom in speculation in real estate and commodities and so on, and suddenly it all went horribly wrong in the middle of 1772 when an investment bank in London collapsed. Now, the problem with it was that it caused all sorts of difficulties. It very nearly led to the financial collapse of the East India Company, the body which had all the tea, which ended up in Boston Harbor. It also had knock-on effects in the colonies too, particularly in Virginia, where many of the tobacco planters of Virginia, relied very heavily on borrowings that they contracted in particularly in Scotland. And there was a period of about a year or so when the flow of credit for the tobacco planters of Virginia just dried up totally. And what that meant was that the Virginians began to become more and more disenchanted, so to speak, with the capabilities of the British Empire. I mean, the whole point of the empire really was that it was supposed to enrich everybody on both sides of the Atlantic. And in the 1770s, it was beginning to look as though that just wasn't happening.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Nick Bunker. And he is a British historian responsible for a number of fine books, the latest of which is called An Empire on the Edge, How Britain Came to Fight America, a Pulitzer Prize finalist. It's a fascinating examination of the state of affairs, which in effect led to the American Revolution. But it is a story told through the eyes of Britain by this British historian. Review of your book described it as one of the only books really well written on the fascinating topic of the mechanics of ruling from afar. I love that phrase, and I quite agree with that reviewer that I think this is one of the most interesting things about this story and about your book. Remind us of just the nearly insurmountable challenges that were involved in that time and place to try to rule from afar, and to what extent it could have been done more effectively had, in a sense, different people been in charge or maybe thought in some innovative ways. I mean, how possible would it have been for Britain to effectively govern the North American continent at that point in time?
Well, the obvious problem is that the most obvious one is the fact of time and distance, that it took so long for messages to pass back and forth to the Atlantic. But it's important not to overemphasize that, because that had been an issue for a very long time, and there were ways of getting around it. The most logical thing for the British to have done, really, would have been to place a viceroy in New York. They would have had to appoint an official, a high-ranking British official, someone with a lot of talent and a lot of experience, to go over to America and become effectively the viceroy of the colonies overall. That is to say, the king's representative, because then he would have been able to react quickly to developments in the colonies when he saw signs of trouble or signs of issues that needed tackling. And he also would have been able to develop an intelligence network. One of the difficulties the British had was that they were dependent on for information very largely on the individual governors of each of the 13 colonies. Now, those 13 governors varied significantly in terms of their talents and in terms of their attitude and in terms of their readiness to actually do some work. Some of them were very diligent, hardworking. Some of them were completely the reverse and rarely sent dispatches back to London. So often there was this kind of great big gap. And the problem of the quality of the colonial governors was really probably one of the three or four top problems that the British faced at the time.
I appreciate the great detail that you with which you describe two of the most important men on the British side in this period, the Prime Minister, Lord North, and then Lord Dartmouth, which in a sense was responsible for the colonies themselves. You describe them in terms that make them sound like, in many ways, quite admirable men, and yet in crucial ways not quite equal to the task that was set before them.
Well, that's right. Now, these two men, Frederick North was the Prime Minister. Lord Dartmouth, actually, his stepbrother, actually, was the colonial secretary. Now, both men in their mid-40s, both highly educated. They'd both been to the same Oxford College, both adept in Latin and Greek and so on. And also, from a private moral point of view, actually, they were paragons of virtue. Both of them were devoted family men. Lord Dartmouth, in particular, was a devout evangelical Christian. He was famous for it at a time when the aristocracy tended not to be the least bit pious, and he was also an early advocate of the abolition of the slave trade. So, and also, Lord Dartmouth, Lord North in particular, was very hardworking. Lord North was constantly attending debates in Parliament, speaking many hundreds of times during his career, and also something of a master of finance. So they had all kinds of qualities, and they were actually men of integrity by the standards of their time. But the difficulty was really, well, there were several difficulties. One of the problems with Lord North was, first of all, he tended to panic. In a crisis, especially a foreign policy crisis, he would be inclined to take decisions that were too hasty. And he would end up committing himself to a course of action that later he would regret. And that's really what happened after the news of the Tea Party riot in 1774. The British government rushed to take decisions within a matter of weeks when it might have been better to delay for a while, and in particular to gather more intelligence from the other colonies just besides Massachusetts. The other problem with Lord North was that he was immensely loyal to his king, to George III. And once George III had taken the view in 1774 that steps needed to be taken to bring Massachusetts securely back within the fold, then there was really no way that Lord North was going to disagree with the king or to take any independent line. And Lord Dartmouth, on the other hand, well, Dartmouth, as I say, was a very pious evangelical Christian, but he had a kind of a streak of authoritarianism in him. And when he eventually reached the conclusion that the colonists were in rebellion, which was the legal advice he received from the government's law offices, once he'd made that decision that the colonists were in rebellion, then in effect he had to commit himself to a policy of fairly stern retribution.
Your book, of course, chronicles in fascinating detail the Boston Tea Party and helps us understand why that phase of the rebellion took place. And I think probably your background as a former investment banker, you know, equips you to understand sort of the economic complexities of that situation better than maybe some other historians. You probably spend even more time with a much less discussed event. I mean, that is, it's prominently discussed by you, but often Americans don't remember the so-called Gaspé affair, which I think occurred about a year before. Briefly, tell our listeners about this and its significance.
Well, that was in June 1772, and with the Gaspé incident, it's very big in Rhode Island because that's where it happened. The people of Rhode Island certainly remember it. What happened was that the mariners and merchants of Providence, Rhode Island, destroyed a Royal Navy warship in the Providence River, a warship named the Gaspé, which was there to patrol the coast to clamp down on the smuggling trade. And the people of Providence were heavily involved in contraband, and so they destroyed this Royal Navy warship. Now, the reason this is important is really, really twofold. Firstly, because, of course, in London, when the news arrived in Whitehall with Lord North and his colleagues, of course, they were horrified, and it helped to harden their attitude substantially. It meant, really, from that moment forth, there was going to be a significant body of opinion within the British government which regarded the Americans as either rebels already or potential rebels. The other reason it was important was because the British didn't respond to it very cleverly. They kind of dithered They knew they were very angry about it, but they couldn't think of any mechanism with which to respond. And the mechanism they came up with, trying to catch the perpetrators from Providence, was doomed to failure. It was doomed to failure because, of course, nobody in Providence would get up in court and testify against the men responsible. And so, therefore, all the British did by responding in that way was simply to antagonize people even more in Rhode Island and New England without actually achieving anything. And then that, in due course, also helped to feed into the anger and bitterness in Massachusetts that led to the Tea Party.
Hmm. At one point in the book, you say that the war had been long in the making, the product of an empire and a system deeply flawed, the work of ignorance and prejudice and of men well-meaning, but the prisoners of ideas that were obsolete and empty. I suppose those are cautionary words for just about anybody in any era, that we need to make sure that as we tackle the most pressing problems and issues and challenges of the day, that we aren't doing so in a sense shackled to ideas that have already run their course and aren't equal to the challenge of the moment.
Well, indeed. I mean, those lines you quote are actually in the closing lines of the book. And what you have to be careful of when you make statements like that in a book as a historian is that you're not simply judging with the benefit of 230 years of hindsight. It's important, if one's going to say a thing like that, as I do, that there were people at the time who felt the same way. And indeed, there were. I think the closing paragraph that you're quoted there also includes a quotation from one of them, a man called the Duke of Richmond. Now, the book doesn't really have any heroes, but my favorite character, perhaps, is the Duke of Richmond, Charles Lennox, the Duke of Richmond. He was a member of the British aristocracy. He was an extremely wealthy man, but he was also very outspoken, and he was by far the most outspoken critic on the British side of the government's response, and by far the most vocal supporter of the American cause. And as I say, he's my favorite character. But it's very important that one can, if one's going to make those kind of statements that you just quoted me making there, that they have some connection with what was actually said at the time, as well as simply being the with hindsight wisdom of someone living two centuries later.
So he says you cannot force a form of government upon a people.
That's right.
And of course, those words prove to be very, very true in this instance. The book again is An Empire on the Edge, How Britain Came to Fight America, a vintage book, a division of Random House, now available in paperback. And the author, Nick Bunker.